of Glittering Delights!
And here, your host, Dandrew Leyland.
Quantum Leap, created by Donald P. Belisario, was a science fiction time travel drama series that aired from March 1989 to May 1993 and starred Scott Bakula as the lead character Dr. Sam Beckett and Dean Stockwell as his collaborator in time, Al. The premise to the show was wackadoodle. Sam Beckett has this theory of time travel, the string ball theory, in which he theorizes that time is like a ball of string. If you bowl it up, all the threads touch, but if you flatten it out, it's one continuous line. So what if you could do that with a life? Ball it up so all parts of that life touched. Beckett applied this to time travel and invented the Quantum Leap Accelerator and successfully travelled in time. But he only transported his consciousness. See, Sam leaps into other people's bodies. To their eyes, he appears as the person he has leapt into. To us, he appears as Scott Bakula. Otherwise, Universal Studios would be paying an actor a lot of money to not actually appear in his show. Al, the observer, is there to help Sam, but can only be seen by Sam, and dogs, and kids, and even then only as a hologram. So all he can provide is moral support, as well as trying to help Sam figure out why he's leapt into this person and what he's here to do to leap out. The series followed Sam leaping from life to life, putting right things that may have previously gone awry and trying to get back home, Sam having no control over the leaps. Ultimately, you remove the window dressing, Quantum Leap was just another wandering man show. Sam would blunder into a new situation every week, help some randos with their problems, and then leave. The main difference with Quantum Leap was that its format was incredibly flexible. There's no need to explain why Sam was in town that week. He just was. He had no idea why, but the writers made his lack of knowledge part of the fun. Sam could be anyone at any time, but in another genius twist, Sam could only leap within his own lifetime. Thankfully, he would not be showing up on the deck of the Titanic or at the Battle of the Alamo. Sam helps real people with real problems, and this ended up being Quantum Leap's biggest asset, its heart. Quantum Leap walked the fine line between maudlin sentimentality and genuine emotion really well, taking a show that could, in lesser hands, have been saccharine and off-putting, and instead gave us a show that was heartfelt and moving. Only ever a moderate hit on NBC in America, Quantum Leap nevertheless managed a decent 5-season run. Here in the UK, it aired on BBC Two from February 13th, 1990 through June 21st, 1994, where it regularly topped the ratings for that channel. BBC, being the BBC, fudged around with the running order, regularly editing the leaps for different ones and thus changing the order of events to better attract an audience. After an 18-month gap between Series 1, which comprised all 8 Season 1 episodes, and the first 2 episodes of Season 2, the BBC rescreened the pilot movie, but edited the ending to have Sam leap into the Season 2 episode, Good Morning Peoria, which they chose to lead off the second run with. Once it found an audience, Quantum Leap had a decent shelf life, being repeated by the BBC through the end of 1999. Now I know what you're thinking, and you're right. You've been here before, you're thinking. Yes, yes, lovely listener, I have. Every episode of the series was discussed on a previous 2-part Alice of Glittering Delights alongside Michael Bailey and Bill Robinson. However, there is a little discussed, rarely commented on part of Quantum Leap lore that is worthy of note. There were comic books. Innovation Comics, a small independent comic book company, was, for a time, the little publisher that could, achieving an impressive market share with barely a single superhero comic at a time where superheroes were dominating the market. Innovation published 13 issues of a Quantum Leap comic book series between 1991 and 1993. Innovation were an interesting company. They managed to claw their way up to being the fourth best-selling publisher in the 90s on the back of some pretty good adaptations of films like Psycho, Forbidden Planet and A Nightmare on Elm Street, TV shows like Beauty and the Beast and Lost in Space, written by series star Bill Mumy, and books like The Executioner series and Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles. The comics were all of a decent quality, often with fully painted covers or interior art. Such it was with Quantum Leap, which was brought to the attention of the head of innovation, David Campitti, by editor George Broderick Jr. as a potential license for the company. Campitti was interested, but had to jump through a few legal hoops to make it happen. Hoops subsequently cleared, the series made its debut in comic shops across the world, and I remember picking up issue one new off the stands. Before I started this read-through, there was only one issue that I actually remembered vividly. Written by Andy Mangles and concerning the Stonewall Riots, this was a revelatory comic book for me, largely because I had no idea about this chapter in American history, and largely because, at the time, this was quite the controversial topic in the letters page. We'll get to that later. Number one, First There Was a Mountain, Then There Was No Mountain, Then There was written by George Broderick Jr., with what looks like art shot directly from the pencils of Mark Jones, and a great painted cover by C. Winston Taylor. This would be consistent throughout the series' run, as Taylor would provide painted covers for them all, and Innovation would release a portfolio of selected covers later on in the year. It's a pretty standard Quantum Leap tale in which Sam leaps into a young English teacher who is actually there to help a bunch of underprivileged kids pass their exams and give them a better future. Sam, however, thinks he's there to prevent Martin Luther King from being murdered. Now, were the Innovation Lost in Space comics use the unlimited budget of comic storytelling to open up the stories in a way that the television show could never afford, nothing about the first issue of Quantum Leap is unique for a comic strip. It translates Quantum Leap into a comic book very well, but it doesn't really stretch it in the way comics can. It's a pretty good first issue, though, emphasising the show's strong social morality messages. Issue 1 went out of print almost immediately and was reprinted with a new cover, new colouring and back matter, covering the first Quantum Leap convention in March 1992, complete with pictures of attending guests Dean Stockwell, Scott Bakula, Donald P. Belisario and the entire writing staff. Personally, I felt the darker colouring of the original printing was better, but your mileage may vary. As with the show, the last page sees Sam leap into his next adventure. In issue 2, Freedom of the Press, had Sam leap into Willie Jackson, a reporter sent to the electric chair for killing his wife's lover. Written by Robert Ingersoll with art by Rob Davis, Sam earns a reprieve, as the case is a political and racial hot potato, with Civil Liberties Group arguing Willie only got the electric chair because he was a black man who killed a white man. In Quantum Leap, it's a bit more complicated than that. In fact, it's a little too complicated. Sam isn't here to save the guy he's leaped into. He's here to stop a reporter who won't reveal a source from killing a doctor who murdered his patients. See, it's revealed that that doctor was acquitted due to said refusal to reveal the source, but the doctor then murdered the reporter's niece, leading to the reporter murdering the doctor. Sam is here to stop all of that, get the doctor arrested, and in the course of this adventure, he manages to get the Leapy off his death sentence. It's faithful to the show, and again, characterisation is good. But we've seen Sam on death row before, and this didn't really feel different enough to justify the repeat. Issue 3 is a Christmas story. He Knows If You've Been Bad or Good, written by John Holland, with art by Andy Price. Interestingly, the comic is following the series by having a different writer and artist every issue, in the same way the TV show had a different writer and director. Readers would probably balk at this nowadays, claiming there's no continuity, but with something episodic like Quantum Leap, this helps the comic feel more like the show. Quantum Leap was, like most shows of the era, not a binge narrative. And in this case, it allows the editor to swap issues around so that the Christmas issue came out at Christmas. Always useful, but also allowed for what would have been the next issue to slip back a bit when the artist had a few problems and couldn't make the deadline. This is a Christmas Quantum Leap story, so it stays just the right side of sentimental eye-rolling, as well as offering up the idea that Sam really has leapt into Santa Claus. It could be cringe, but it isn't. This story actually plays really well. It's Christmas. It's a time for miracles. So be of good cheer and enjoy this simple 11-page story. Sam is here to help a young girl realise that her father being a good Samaritan is no bad thing when all of his little good deeds throughout the year add up to a Santa's sack full of goodwill from his neighbours when his own problems threaten his family. Story 2, The Infinite Corridor by Link Yacko and Andy Price is a fun short story. Sam leaps into an MIT student whose girlfriend will reveal the secret that will allow Sam to put together Project Quantum Leap. However, she's suffering from severe bigotry on campus, being an Asian American at the height of the Vietnam War. Sam is to stop her from quitting the program and not complete her degree, because if she doesn't, that makes her discovery null and void, and thus Project Quantum Leap will never be. And Sam would now be part of a major time paradox. This is actually a pretty great story, probably the best one so far. There are real stakes, real emotions, and time travel shenanigans, although we don't want them to go to the well of Sam having to somehow protect himself every issue, or that would be dull. The series only did that once or twice in 5 years. Sam also wants to tell her that Vietnam will be over in 5 years' time, but obviously can't reveal how he knows that. Al, as horny as ever, encourages Sam to take full advantage of the situation. Because of course he does. Issue 4, the $50,000 quest, sees Sam leap into a game show contestant, Dan Morgenstern, caught up in a scandal of getting the questions before the show aired and thus cheating. Al thinks Sam is here to win, as $25,000 of next week's show's money would, or will be, or was, whatever, donated to MIT and used in research that would help Sam develop the hologram technology utilised by Al. I just said that the series only did this twice in 5 years, and this is the second time the comic book has gone back to the well of Sam being here to do something to enable Project Quantum Leap to happen, and in back-to-back stories. This is stretching credulity, even for Quantum Leap, because it kind of undermines that Sam was bright enough to come up with all this himself if he has to keep changing other people's lives so that their invention allows him to make Project Quantum Leap happen. The story, for what it is fine. Writer Stephen Dorfman does a good job with the characterisation, but the story is wrapped up very conveniently and rather quickly. If this were an episode, it would have been buried somewhere around episode 15. Not bad, but not great. Nice cover of Sam on Wheel of Fortune, though, even though he doesn't actually go on Wheel of Fortune. Pedantry alert. Issue 5 started very well. Seeing is Believing by Terry Collins and art by Rob Davis sees Sam leap into newspaper reporter Hank Briscoe, who just happens to look a lot like Clark Kent. It seems like a clear case of stop Hank drinking himself to death when, wouldn't you know it, Sam comes across a kid who, in the future, will be part of NASA's development of the Star Bright program, aka Project Quantum Leap. What are the odds? Sam solves both problems as well as proving UFOs are real. Again, we're having Sam do something that makes the project happen. I think we should be knocking that stuff off right about now. 3 times in a row is too much. Issue 6, A Tale of Two Cindys, is written by George Broderick Jr. and Becky Broderick, with art by Andy Price. This was an absolutely brilliant issue that genuinely felt like an episode of the show. Sam leaps into Cindy, whose twin sister, Sandy, is about to be raped by the school jock. This being 1959, such things weren't talked about, but the situation ruined Sandy's life. It's up to Sam to stop it from ever happening. This issue was structured exactly like an episode. The first page was the saga cell, then the second page was the teaser, and then the credits. A wonderful design of the Quantum Leap logo with various historical events in each letter. The story then began and threw up some interesting wrinkles, such as Sandy being able to partially see or be aware of Al because of Cindy being her twin, which is a genuinely good idea. There's even one point where she actually sees Sam and not Cindy out of the corner of her eye. This makes real sense within the framework of the show. If it's Sam's neurons and mesons and brain and all that stuff linked to Al that allows them to see each other, then Cindy and Sandy would be this pretty much the same, being twins. I was impressed by it. It makes as much sense as anything else does in Quantum Leap, let's be honest. There's even some continuity with the show, with mentions of Sam leaping into Buddy Holly and the twins' brother watching Captain Galaxy on the television. The real delight, though, is the story. It's always a treat when Sam takes down a real scumbag. But in this story, it's not the scumbag we think it's going to be. Second, Sam isn't there to stop the rape. He's actually there for a completely different reason. Solving this, then Sam leaps again into Sandy, this time to stop the rape. It's a genuinely brilliant twist, as the reason for it was set up throughout, and I'd missed it completely on first read-through. Well done, George and Becky Broderick. A genuinely great story. Plus, eight pages of letters. You don't get that nowadays. Issue 7 features two stories. In the first, Sam is a golfer whose addiction to work is ruining his life. Routine and rather dull, the art by Dan and Dave Day is its saving grace. The second story has Sam leap into a bus driver to stop a case of child abuse. Nothing we haven't seen before, although it may be of some note to Honeymooners fans. Issue 8 is back on track. Written by William Spangler with art by Mike Diodato Sr., this story, Getaway, is set in 1958 and sees Sam leap into a bank robber, Vic Starkey. What makes this a different kind of tale is that it's told mostly from Starkey's point of view. We see the project, what happens to the people Sam leaps into, and what they remember about their experience, and how their side of the story affects them. And this was done before the episode, Killing Time, which did a similar thing. I've been saying that the comic hasn't really taken advantage of being a comic, so this issue was a treat. Also of note, and as with most comics of the time, there were updates from the editor, and some of these updates referred to the show. Apparently, producers wanted to do an animated episode, which Bakula was really looking forward to, probably because it would be a voiceover gig and it would give him a week off. But, sadly, like the Godzilla episode of Moonlighting, this never eventuated. We'd have to wait for Farscape and Supernatural for an animated episode of a live-action show. Although, sadly, neither Farscape nor Supernatural have attempted a Godzilla episode. Issue 9 is the powerful issue I mentioned earlier on, written by and featuring a text piece by Andy Mangles. A direct sequel to the television episode Goodnight, Dear Heart, up against a stone wall sees Sam leap into the body of Stephanie Haywood, who Sam sent to prison in the aforementioned episode. The episode was not popular with the LGBTQ plus audience of the time, and Mangles attempts to address that here by having Sam involved in the Stonewall riots. I remember being fascinated by this issue when I read it when it came out, as I wasn't even aware of Stonewall. And, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this was one of the few issues I remembered before embarking upon this read-through. It genuinely opened my eyes and led to a deeper awareness of gay rights. Mangles does a great job with it, addressing issues that are still topical today. And whilst it shows how far we have come, it also shows how far we have yet to go. Nice art, again, by Mike Diodato, and this time they spell his surname correctly. Issue 10, Too Funny for Words, written by Peter Quinones with art by John Garcia, is a pure character piece with little action. And for the first three quarters of the story, Al has no idea why Sam is here. This allows the writer to create characters we like, and ones we don't, as we follow Sam as a Lenny Bruce-style comedian constantly being harassed by the police for his material. A lot of this was mined later on The Marvellous Mrs. Maisel, which shows how ahead of its time this comic was. It's a very low-key issue, with some lettering mistakes, but if it was cast well, it could have been a nice episode of the show, dealing with free speech and all that that entails. The text piece and letters page discuss the notion of the comic repeating or prefiguring ideas from the show, and discussions about how production schedules work in both print and television. We've seen licensed media often tell stories similar to the licenses they are adapting a few times, particularly in Star Trek, and a good idea is a good idea. Let's be honest, when you're both drinking from the same well, sometimes the water's going to get mixed up. Issue 11 is another sensitively handled story on a tough subject matter. Sam leaps into a doctor who is part of a government-sponsored program to test drugs on normal people. Sam, being Sam, is appalled by this and vows to get the program shut down. The problem is, Al doesn't know if that's what Sam is here to do, as Black Book operations are notorious for their secrecy, and Al can't find anything about who Sam is. Writer Bruce Scallet's script is wordy but interesting, and the issues raised are commendably given full voice, but offer no answers. This makes the story one of the more thought-provoking ones in the run, looking at constitutional rights and the introduction of the reading of the Miranda rights to criminals, which Sam uses his knowledge of to good effect. Good art, again, by Mike Diodato Sr. Issue 12 is a change of pace issue in which Sam leaps into a gas station attendant in the middle of nowhere. It allows for Sam and Al to just chat for 24 pages, and this is actually a lot more interesting than it sounds. From Al theorising Sam's leaping around in time results in the clothes he wore being unstable molecules to explain how they fit, to the pontificating about how the product actually works, to how sex is viewed in the media and in society, this was a surprisingly good story. Mike Diodato is in danger of giving this series a regular artist, and he does a great job in this issue, which lives or dies on its likenesses of the actors. Dressing Sam like Mr. Mystix Pitalik is also a nice touch. Scott Rockwell does an equally good job with the story, and if the denouement of Sam ensuring Marilyn Monroe has an acting career is a little too similar to giving Buddy Holly the lyric to Peggy Sue, well, it's quantum leaping for you. The final page is a leap into the upcoming annual. Apparently, Sam was to leap into Ziggy, the Quantum Leap computer, but for some reason, this never saw print. What did see print was issue 13, the final issue of the run, although the back page has a subscription ad through issue 24. The editor also states categorically that the comic is not cancelled like the TV show, which had recently come to an end. One Giant Leap, written by Christine Elaine Hansopoulos, with art by Luke Ross and Mike Diodato Sr., sees Sam leap into a grey alien busy abducting humans, in this case from New York. Sam is there to get the humans released. This is an interesting story. Ziggy has nothing on alien abduction that can be considered legitimate for Al to work with, so Al struggles to find Sam, especially given that he can't just ask the alien in the waiting room because they can't speak English. Ziggy starts watching old TV shows to help Sam out, and Ziggy's suggestion that Sam find the transporter room and beam down was very funny given where Scott Bakula's career path would ultimately lead him. The final page is a leap into a baby, another story that never saw print. There are further assurances in the letters page that the comic will continue, and it even teased further stories such as the return of the evil leaper from the fifth season of the show. The editor talks as if another year of the comic was a done deal, and how the cancellation of the series would free up the comic book creators to tell many different kinds of stories. This was not to be. For some reason, Innovation went out of business in early 1994, rather quickly. The Quantum Leap comic is now very hard to get hold of. Innovation shutting down meant that the rights to the comics are probably floating around in the ether somewhere. Had this been a more modern book, there probably would have been a trade paperback of at least the early issues, but that wasn't part of the business model in the early 1990s. Like the series, these stories would never be resolved, and Sam would continue to bounce around in time, taking the long road getting from there to here. Comics are, overall, a nice addition to the canon, creating essentially another season of the show for leapers, and given that there has never been an official continuation of Sam's journey, I assume he's still out there. Somewhere, some when, striving to put right what once went wrong, and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home. Okay, let's have a look at the email, shall we? I have a couple of emails, actually, which is very nice. Hey, Andrew. Hey, Matt Prather. For 'tis he who has emailed. I have to say, I completely agree with your coverage on the post-Star Wars Hollywood climate. Some of the movies you covered are some of my favourite films from that era. Dune has been watched in our home a lot more than anyone but me is comfortable with. One successful project getting another greenlit is an interesting subject, especially in cinema. Thanks for sharing, you rock. Thank you, Matt Prather. Now, thank you, Matt, for emailing in. P.S. Gotta go watch Flash Gordon now. Yeah, Flash Gordon was a notable mention. I should have said that, but completely forgot, because, you know, that's what it is. But Flash Gordon is a great movie. I watched it not that long ago on ITV4. Still very entertaining. Next email today is from Robert Ludwig. Hey, Andy. Hey, Robert. First, I want to say thanks for all the many hours of listening you have provided over the years. I appreciate listening to your thoughts on many subjects, some of which I know about and some I don't. Just expanding my horizons. You are very welcome. I would like to get these out a little bit more regular than I do at the moment, but, you know, it is what it is. I wish I was getting paid for it so I could do it on a regular basis, but it is, you know, like I said, life gets in the way, doesn't it? Now on to the episode. I was figuring the Last Starfighter was on the list, and when you got to number one, I said it out loud in my car before you said it. Always the best podcaster. I think I've heard you talk about the movie before on other podcasts, which is why I figured it was there. Yeah, me and Scott Garner did an episode about the Last Starfighter. Anyway, this movie has been a favourite of mine. I know I didn't see it in the theatre. It was either from a movie rental place or on cable, but I've watched it often. In real life, I don't know of anyone else who's heard of this movie, which is weird because I remember it being popular. The thing, you know, the thing I do remember, Robert, if you rented it, and I did, I rented it quite a lot of times because I love this film. The opening credits are stretched. They're not panned and scanned for some reason, which they would do on opening credits, or they would make the opening credits widescreen, wouldn't they? And then when the film started, they'd go into pan and scan. But the opening credits of The Last Starfighter and Vader were stretched. So the planet Earth that you see in the opening credits is an egg shape. So when I was watching it as a kid for years, I didn't think that was Earth because it wasn't shaped like Earth. It was really weird. It was only when I saw it in widescreen finally that I realized what they'd done to it to make it fit the 4x3 frame. Anyway, Robert continues, I was also happy to hear another childhood favorite on the list at number three, The Black Hole. I remember seeing this movie at the movie rental place in its white Disney box. I think we rented it at least one time a year, if not more, for quite a while. I've rewatched it a couple of times on Disney Plus and still enjoy it. I know as a kid I was confused as heck by that ending. Being older and reading some things online has helped some, or at least given some ideas about what people think has happened. If you haven't already, Robert, track down a copy of Alan Dean Foster's novelization for The Black Hole. I read an interesting interview with Alan Dean Foster when he was trying to get Disney to give him his royalty money for his Star Wars novels. And they were saying to him, when you did a lot of movie novelizations, were you ever tempted to change any of them? And I think he mentioned that The Black Hole was the only novel he ever wrote that was adapting a film where he changed the ending to make it make more sense. So if you're of a mind, see if you can find a copy of it. I see The Black Hole around everywhere in secondhand science fiction bookshops, so it shouldn't be hard to get hold of. But it's worth giving a read if you're a big fan of the film. Keep putting them out and I will keep listening. Thank you, Robert Ludwig, Nevada, Iowa. Do you just work in outer space? I'm sure I've said that before. I'll believe in anything when I'm there. I'm certain I've said that before. Anyway, thank you very much, lovely people, for continuing your support of my vanity project. Like I said, I would love to get it to be a bit more regular than it is. But life gets in the way. I am hoping to carry on with Spider-Man in the very near future. Thanks to a text message, I'm considering doing Bill Mantlo's stuff on Peter Parker instead of moving over to Roger Stern. So that may be interesting. The thing with that is they have to actually dig the comics out because they've not actually been released digitally as far as I know. Anyway, thank you very much. I will see you all again real soon. Everything's gonna be fine, hopefully, possibly, maybe. Take care, be good to yourselves, and I'll be back in the future because that's where we're all gonna live. Bye-bye.